Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama today at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, where both Presidents Kennedy and Reagan made historic speeches calling for Russia and the U.S. to reduce their nuclear arsenals by one-third. Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss the need for the U.S. to get rid of thousands of these Cold War relics, whether or not the Russians reciprocate. Then we will speak with Paulo Sotero, the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center and the former Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper. We will discuss the nationwide protests in Brazil that began over police brutality in response to public protests over a rise in bus fares and have since spread to protests at soccer stadiums being built for next year's World Cup, where minority voices are making themselves heard about the need for investments in health, education, and social services. Then finally, we'll examine the issue of the domestic use of drones that came up in a Senate hearing today, where the outgoing head of the FBI said that drones have been used in America against Americans in a very minimal way with a very small footprint. Ryan Callow, a professor of law at the University of Washington, who was the former research director at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford University, joins us to discuss today's hearings and his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the domestic use of drones. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joseph Cerincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed Nonproliferation International Policy Programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Governmental Operations and served as a staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And the president made a speech today at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin where he called for a one-third reduction in the arsenals, the nuclear arsenals of both the U.S. and Russia. This is following a rather chilly meeting at the G8 meeting in Northern Ireland with Putin. Already, of course, the Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin has thrown some cold water on it. So what are the chances of the Russians... Yeah.
Well, the Russians are dragging their heels on this. There's no question about it. If they were more cooperative, we could more quickly reduce these excessive and obsolete nuclear weapons that we have. And the president clearly indicated his intention to negotiate further with the Russians. But he's not handcuffing his policy to the Russians. He's not going to let them dictate how many weapons we have or how much we spend on this Cold War arsenal. He clearly opened the door to making reductions regardless of what the Russians do. And the reason is clear. We have many, many more nuclear weapons than we need. It's hard to imagine using one nuclear weapon. We haven't for 68 years. 10 nuclear weapons in use would be a catastrophe beyond history, and 100 is completely unmanageable. We have 7,000. We spend about $50 to $60 billion a year to maintain this arsenal. That's what the president is getting at when he says it's time to modernize our national security policy for the 21st century.
My understanding is that within the nuclear arsenal itself, those that maintain it, for example, the people under the prairies in those silos, that there's been recent reports indicating a drop in morale. They've had to transfer a bunch of officers with their finger on the button because of poor morale. It would seem that guarding these obsolete weapons is difficult to maintain morale. One of the peculiar paradoxes of that report was that during the Cold War, the morale was high. In other words, these officers were prepared to press the button and obliterate mankind. Now they don't see the purpose of doing it. So isn't there a kind of nuclear rot, if you will, within our own nuclear services?
Ian, I think that's an excellent way of describing it. And, you know, whatever value these nuclear weapons may have had during the Cold War, whatever feelings officers may have had, that they were the front line, that they were the guardians of the ultimate guardians of the national security, that is long since gone. And now we take some of our best and brightest Air Force officers and we stick them in holes in the ground in Montana and Wyoming and North Dakota where they wait and wait and wait to push buttons they know they are never going to push. So So they know they're in dead-end jobs, and morale is suffering because of that. We just had a couple of dozen officers disqualified at the ICBM base in North Dakota as unfit to do their jobs. So you have a major morale problem here, particularly with the ICBM fleet. And then you have cost issues. You know, we have 14 nuclear-armed submarines patrolling the ocean still, with over 800, almost 1,000 nuclear warheads ready to go. Well, we're cutting that fleet, but we now have plans to replace it with 12 new submarines, a whole new generation. Well, this is causing major budget problems for the Navy. If they build those nuclear-armed subs, they're going to be cutting their conventional fleet by 40%. So you're seeing big debate inside the Navy going, why are we doing this? Why are we still building the weapons? That's why you see a growing military consensus that we can safely reduce the number of weapons. The kinds of cuts the president announced today are just the beginning.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. So the president clearly choosing the Brandenburg Gate as the venue in the German capital, Berlin, is definitely echoing President Kennedy's famous speech, Ich bin ein Berliner, and of course Ronald Reagan's famous speech, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. What's your sense? I mean, the stuff that I've been getting over the website, you know, I get solicitations from right-wing groups that outnumber left-wing groups by about 1,000 to 1. But the left-wing groups that are sending me solicitations is talking about this is all smoke and mirrors, it's all nonsense, etc. Why is there that sense on the left that Obama's not serious?
Well, there's two things. One, he's definitely consciously wrapping himself in the legacy of John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. Both of them were nuclear abolitionists. Both of them wanted to get rid of these weapons. You remember Kennedy saying we have to abolish the weapons of war before they abolish us. And Reagan said his goal was to eliminate nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. So Obama understands that. He's carrying that forward. The concern is that Obama gave a great speech in Prague in 2009, laid out a very ambitious nuclear agenda, made 2 years of great progress, and then stopped. And his nuclear agenda has been dead in the water for the last two years. What you saw today was the president restarting this agenda, saying that, yes, this is still one of my top priorities. And I've talked to top officials in the White House and the State Department. I know that the president cares about this deeply. The Secretary of State, John Kerry, Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, care about this agenda deeply. The challenge is now for the president to match his promise with his programs. Is he going to cut the nuclear weapons budget? Is he going to follow through on the negotiations? Is he going to push the allies to get those obsolete nuclear weapons out of Europe? The last line of the White House guidance is probably the most important thing that was said today. The president has directed all his agencies to start implementing these policies over the next year. So the struggle to implement the president's policy has just begun today.
So when you said earlier, Joseph Cerincione, that the president is not entirely dependent upon the Russian reciprocity in this, what can he do given the churlish attitude on the part of Putin and Rogozin?
Well, the Russian force is already coming down. They have several hundred fewer strategic nuclear weapons deployed right now than we do. And the reason is that their forces are aging, they're getting obsolete, and they're retiring them faster than they can replace them. It looks like they'll go down to about 1,000 by the end of this decade. So we can simply follow them down. I mean, we can take our warheads off alert. The president promised he would do that. We can take them, put them into storage. We can follow them down, knowing that the Russians can't catch up. There's also internal Pentagon studies that say this isn't any conceivable scenario where the Russians can gain an advantage on us. You know, it's not a matter of we have to match them warhead for warhead. You know, 10 warheads is enough to deter a foe from attacking us. You don't need thousands. So those are the kinds of cards that the president has, getting away from this Cold War thinking about, you know, mutually assured destruction and recognizing that a few hundred nuclear weapons are more than you need. We don't need to maintain an arsenal of thousands. And in the process, we can save money shifting it for the real threats of the 21st century.
But do the Russians feel a greater need for their arsenal than the U.S., given the fact that their conventional forces have dissipated considerably since the end of the Cold War and the breakup of the Soviet Union?
They do, and they place a greater role in the so-called tactical nuclear weapons, the weapons they would use in a European battle. But, you know, to be real, there isn't going to be a European battle. There's not going to be a European war. So you have to be patient with the Russians, work with them on this. And still, even with that concern, you can still get them down to a few hundred nuclear weapons, down from the 8,000 or so that they have. You can involve the other nuclear-armed countries, and the president talked about this, such as China, India, and Pakistan in these kinds of discussions. There's a clear path forward, and you just got to notch it forward. And history is on our side. The arsenals that we had at the Cold War, when Reagan made his speech, we had about 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world. We're now down to 17,000. The arsenals have been cut by almost 80%, and they're clearly going to go lower. The curve is bending away from nuclear weapons, away from integrating these weapons as key parts of national security strategies. That's the arc that the president is pushing. That's the wave that he's riding.
And is he being pushed in any way by, for example, there's a movement in the Netherlands to get nuclear weapons off Dutch soil?
Yeah, so in that, we have about 200 hydrogen bombs still stationed in Europe, these B-61 bombs. We have a program to modernize these bombs. It's going to cost us $10 billion to modernize these weapons. And for what? Well, the Dutch and the Germans are two of the bases where these are based. They say they want them out. The Turks are a little more ambivalent about it. The Italians, they don't care one way or the other. And it's really the Eastern European countries, Poland, the Baltic states, that see these as a political symbol of U.S. commitment. Well, there are cheaper ways to demonstrate our political support for these countries and our unity with them. You don't have to spend $10 billion on obsolete bombs to do that. The president has to be a little more imaginative on how he does it. And you saw him talk about that today. He wants to work the issue. The test will be whether he does, whether he stays with it. Does he put the time and political capital into saving the United States some money and modernizing our national security strategy?
So I'm trying to get a handle here, Joe Cerciani, on where the lobbying is coming from for nuclear weapons. If we're going to spend $10 billion upgrading obsolete hydrogen bombs that the Germans and the Dutch want off their soil, and you were just telling us a minute ago that the Joint Chiefs and the top brass in the Navy, for example, don't want to buy any more nuclear submarines with nuclear missiles, the so-called boomers, because there's already enough, and this money could go to what they consider to be better use in conventional weaponry. So you've got clearly some push coming from that direction. So what is the push? Who is this pro-nuclear lobby that want to keep throwing good money after bad?
Well, it's the same kind of lobby that you get whenever you want to cut a government program. It's the people who are making money off the contracts, the people who have jobs related to the program, the people who have billets, officer positions related with it. So you see some of the senators, for example, from states that have ICBM bases, like Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, resisting cutting nuclear weapons. They don't want to lose the bases. So the trick there is to find other purposes for those bases. You see some of the contractors who make money at our nuclear labs, like Los Alamos or Livermore, saying, well, no, this is a necessary program. We have to spend $10 billion. This is essential national security. What happens is that those demands are now meeting the budget reality. You don't have enough money. The defense budget is coming down, so those are being pitted against other more vital defense needs. And politically, you see the defense hawks that used to dominate the Republican Party having resistance within their own party from the deficit hawks, the people who want to cut the budget. So you can understand where the call for more nuclear weapons or staying with the nuclear weapons program is coming from. These people who are still clinging to these obsolete weapons for financial or career reasons. That's just a decreasing voice. They are losing influence, and they know it.
So is it a combination then of the budget realities? But what about the external reality that it doesn't make any sense? I mean, they're on pretty shaky ground, and I'm just wondering what can be done for reality to catch up to this atavism.
Well, you should add into that political opponents. So, you know, the president's political opponents take every issue and try to use it as an attack on the president, show that he's weak or naive or jeopardizing national security, you know. And so you hear some of that being reflected in some of the comments in Congress today. On the other side, you have some of the leaders of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin, for example, saying that we have many more nuclear weapons than we need and we can certainly cut the budget. Adam Smith, the Democratic leader of the House Armed Services Committee, just issued a statement today applauding the president's. So you see some of the more common sense defense-minded congressman, understanding the need to rationalize. And overall, I think the combination of the decreasing threat and the budget realities are going to be the overriding factor in shrinking the nuclear arsenal. It's a fight, though. Nothing is given. We can see where the trends are going. But if the American people don't want their Congress spending their money on these weapons, they have to let them know. This is a democracy, and the voice of the people matters.
Well, just in closing, Joseph Cerisani, my understanding is the biggest and best bang for the buck the American people ever got was the Nunn-Lugar program that spent U.S. tax dollars inside Russia itself as the Soviet Union fell apart to secure these weapons and to secure the nuclear material so it didn't end up in the hands of rogues and terrorists, etc. And that is the most likely scenario of the use of nuclear weapon, outside of the fact that Pakistan has the fastest growing arsenal and maybe India and Pakistan may stumble into a nuclear war. But short of that, which is not entirely likely, there's still a great possibility of nuclear weapons ending up in the hands of so-called terrorists. So where does that stand now? Because I understand that the Republicans pretty much killed that program. I mean, again, you feel like somebody's got to be an advocate for reality out there.
Well, you're exactly right, Ian, about the importance of that. And fortunately, it has a solid bipartisan support. So even though in the early days there was some Republican opposition, by now it's solidified in Congress. The two pieces of good news, one is just last week, just earlier this week, the Russians re-upped the program. The program had lapsed. There were some concerns about liability issues, about who was to blame if something went wrong. Well, those have all been negotiated out, and the U.S. and Russians announced at the Obama-Putin summit that they were going to extend the program and continue it. So that's good news number one. Good news number two is the president announced today that he's continuing his so-called nuclear security summits. Every 2 years, he's gathered 50 nations together to pool resources to secure and eliminate all the weapons usable material in the world. It's a tough job, but we're making steady progress. He just announced that he's going to continue the process through 2016 and convene them once again in Washington. So we'll have a nuclear security summit next year in the Netherlands and then in 2016 back in Washington. So these are all good signs for securing loose nukes and preventing terrorists from getting the one weapon that could destroy an American city.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Joseph Cerisani.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cerisani, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Governmental Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about protests all across Brazil.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.